We made this.
With the mic on, I'm less dangerous. Here I am now. Entertain us. No, wait. The grammar's wrong. Hi, I'm Matthew Latham. You're listening to Pick a Disc, the show where people pick a disc and they talk about it for whatever reason they want to. Generally, it's positive stuff. So, this week my guest is Rob Yeomans from the Cinemortuary podcast on the We Made This podcast network. And he's going to be talking about a band who are quite influential and quite big and had a big impact on the music industry. And we talk about the lead singer and a couple of the side projects of the other band members as well. But we talk about the album and we talk a bit about the lasting legacy and the impact that older bands can have on music tastes currently as well. It's a quite an interesting conversation, and I really enjoyed talking to Rob about this. I really enjoyed listening to it, and I did quite like this album. How much? Keep listening to find out. In what's becoming a Pick a Disc tradition for me at the moment is, it's not the first time that I've been trying to find someone on Skype and it's either not connected properly or there's been several. So you have no idea how many people use the same name.
I know. It's a challenge. It's a very strange thing. I mean, you came up top of my list, Matt, which was good news. But yeah, it's a quirk of the software, perhaps.
Yeah, I mean, it wouldn't actually find you until I put your full username in, until it says one mutual friend, which I believe is Chris Wilson.
I would have thought so. Yes, my co-host on my podcast. Yeah,
who appeared on the episode 5 to talk about Limp Bizkit.
He did.
Yeah, which is to this date the only episode where I've been a bit negative about the album, and at the moment it's still the most listened to.
Of course it is.
At least 100 downloads.
And I think Chris at the time was feeling quite smug about the fact that he thought nobody would guess the album that he'd picked, and everybody correctly guessed the album he picked, so he was a little bit let down by that, I think.
his co-host on Without a Mouse, Tim, pretty much put on Twitter, he goes, it's probably something like Limp Bizkit.
Yeah.
And you can
we
kind
all
of,
called it, yeah.
Yeah, you can kind of see he's kind of like, oh, his face kind of like bright going, oh. But we won't be talking about Chris Wilson for the majority of this podcast, else we'll end up talking about wrestling.
We'll disappear into a real rabbit warren then.
Yeah, definitely. We are going to be talking about an album that you've picked by a band that some people may have heard of. It's in the upper echelon of popularity of bands.
It is not a niche pick.
No. So we are very much near the kind of U2 levels of notoriety here. So without beating around the subject, Rob, why don't you explain what is the disc that you've picked today?
Sure. So the disc I have picked today is Nirvana's 1993 follow-up to their mega hit Nevermind, which was In Utero.
In Utero. In Utero, you said, is the third and final album by Nirvana. It was released on the 21st of September 1993 on DGC Records, which I had actually heard of until I clicked the link on the Wikipedia page and found it was a subdivision of Interscope. That's probably something that might crop up later on. There are two credited producers, Steve Albini and Scott Litt, and it pretty much received a lot of critical acclaim, but we'll talk about that a bit later on. But the first question, as I ask everyone, Rob, why have you chose In Utero?
So I have chosen In Utero because it's an album that I've always had quite a strong connection to. I came across Nirvana firstly through Nevermind and Smells Like Teen Spirit and all of that, which is obviously the most common access route. And I absolutely loved loved that album. And as you do when you get into a band, you sort of look to discover the rest of their discography, which in Nirvana's case isn't too large. And I came across this album, I think probably I was about maybe 13, 14 when I bought it on CD. And it was such a departure from Nevermind, but at the same time there's a sort of common link, a common theme of the structure of a lot of the music on it. And it's so raw against Nevermind, which Kurt Cobain at the time, after it was released, felt it was a little bit overproduced. So the two producers on this album are actually quite an interesting story, which I'll cover a little bit with you later. But yeah, it's almost like a sort of down and dirty version of Nevermind is the way I usually describe it. And that's the reason I picked it.
I've not listened to a whole album of them before, so this is the first album I've actually listened to. I mean, I don't know that many songs. I probably know a couple of the odd song here and there that I might have seen. I definitely know the cover of Man Who Saw the World by David Bowie.
Yes.
And I think one or two that I probably heard on like MTV way back in the day. But sure. then there's Smells Like Teen Spirit, which you really can't avoid anywhere. And to be fair, I'll tell you exactly what I've written down in my notes. There's a section I've got called My Disclosure, and all there is Smells Like Teen Spirit. I mean, come on. It smells like teen, ...IN... spirit.
Yes.
Yeah.
Exactly. I think that sums it up, doesn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it's not on this album, but I mean, even if you've not a Nirvana fan, you must have crossed paths with Smells Like Teen Spirit. The song itself is probably a key reason for a lot of bands that are recording now and have been in the last like 25 odd years who pretty much use distortion on the guitars and kind of like don't take off sweets when they sing. It's a great song anyway. I mean, the amount of like club nights I remember going to, and that's the song that plays.
Yeah. And to this day as well, which is testament to the power of a song that I think is 28 years old now.
And also it's one of Weird Al's better parodies as well.
Yes, it is. Yeah, it is.
Yeah, and to be fair, I mean, I sometimes get them mixed up. So, like, even the chorus, if I'm listening to the actual song, I think, like, years and years ago, like when I used to go out to like rockier clubs, I probably end up singing the Weird Al lyrics to it as well. It's Nirvana.
Exactly. It buries in your mind. There's also a very funny back in about 12 years ago, there was a bit of a fad of people fusing and remixing songs together on YouTube, and one of the greatest such fusions I've ever come across is Smells Like Teen Spirit, which was somebody fused with Bootylicious by Destiny's Child. And it fits frighteningly perfectly, so I recommend you have a check it out after this.
Yeah, definitely. I'm a massive fan of the mashups, if I'm completely honest. But again, Smells Like Teen Spirit has a massive, massive legacy on its own, opposed from Nevermind. But we're talking about the follow-up. So you've got, like one, perhaps the current biggest rock band in the world at that moment in time, releasing perhaps one of the most important rock albums of the early 90s. And so the band have to record a follow-up, and they come out with In Utero. Yeah, and you said it's a very different departure from...
Yeah, I think In Utero, in a lot of ways, is the band's, and especially Kurt Cobain's, retort to the success and fame that came with Nevermind. And I think Kurt Cobain, it's kind of fairly well documented, never wanted to be famous. He wanted to achieve a sort of a sweet spot of success where he wasn't recognized on the street, but he, you know, earned enough of a living to live his life through his music. And I think that obviously the success of Nevermind, as is well documented, did not do Kurt Cobain any favors mentally, or indeed in his life and his relationships.
Yeah, so I think this is kind of, this is very similar to, like, I can't think of a name of it. There's probably, like, an actual, like, term for it. But I can't speak for the previous albums, but this is very an autobiographical album. So I don't know whether the previous albums were like that. But by autographical, I mean in the same vein that... The first name that pops into my head is, like, the second episode of this podcast, we did Say Anything, and Max Bemis is very much a lot of Say Anything are songs about Max Bemis. It's like Eminem is pretty much an artist about, that writes songs about Eminem. And this album especially is pretty much Nirvana talking, well, Kurt Cobain, writing lyrics about Kurt Cobain.
Yes.
And I don't know, are the previous albums in that similar vein?
No, they're not. And I think that's the key difference with this album, really, versus the previous two. So Nirvana's debut album, Bleach, was released in 1988. And that album was on a label called Sub Pop. And it was very much more in the vein of a punk album. It was kind of punk, but at times metal influenced. And the sound was very, very early in its stages of development. It was quite an experimental album in a lot of ways. And then obviously Nevermind came along after that on the, DGC, yeah. So that's, at the time, it was more commonly known as Geffen. It was David Geffen's record company. And that was how he made his name initially. He went on to become one of the founders of DreamWorks with Steven Spielberg. But he initially was a record producer and developed his label. And I believe they had quite a bit of success in the rock genre in the sort of late 80s, early 90s, and Nirvana was signed off the strength of Bleach to a multiple album deal with them. And Nevermind was the first of that deal.
Oh, okay. So that's quite interesting then, because I was fully expecting for it to kind of be like the cult of the lead singer, as like other bands, and particularly the rap genre, actually. Like the rap genre, I think... It's like slight tangent, because I think the rap genre, particularly like with NWA and or like pretty much a lot of the rap artists that kind of grew up in the early 90s, around the same time as this actually, where you'd get, but they was pretty much very much autobiographical. Then they hit success and then their circumstances change, and so the subjects of what they're talking about change. And that's, and eventually that's how you get a lot of the like cars and bling kind of subject matter. But and again, I'll link back to Eminem. Eminem pretty much probably had the surprise breakout that he wasn't expecting. So a lot of pretty much the Marshall Mathers LP and the Eminem show was him kind of talking about dealing with fame and his reaction to it. And I think about, what, 10 years beforehand, this is something very similar, only in a completely different genre. And it's I find it to be quite clever, and it's either quite clever, subtle, and unclever and unsubtle at the same time.
Yes, exactly, yeah. And the sort of self-referencing, there is a little bit of that in Nevermind to an extent. So, for example, the song that we all know and talk about, Smells Like Teen Spirit, was infamously named so because Kurt Cobain was dating a woman at the time, and she scrawled on his apartment wall that Kurt smells like Teen Spirit, which was an American deodorant brand, apparently, that he wore. And he took that on and named the song after that moment in his life.
Without being around the bush, it's my opinion on the album is that I absolutely loved it.
Brilliant. Well, that's a good start.
I thought it was great. And I'm pretty much in two minds of whether to say whether this I might have actually liked this more than I did Stranger in the Alps by Phoebe Bridgers, which is still the current reigning favourite.
Yeah,
that I've been like privy to. Of albums that I've listened to because of the podcasts, taking it aside from ones that I've been familiar with. Yeah, I really enjoyed it, and I think a lot of it is because it's kind of like looking back in a family tree. I mean, a lot of my current music taste is very much like kind of not exactly pure punk. It's more kind of not exactly grunge. But there's a lot of bands that are kind of either mixed indie pop, or if you a bit further down the spectrum, my taste, bands that pretty much like forget to turn off the distortion pedal, and that makes it sound a bit more like grungy stuff. And I can pretty much feel like their influences of like several different bands from different kind of places in my taste, kind of like feel like they came from either if not this album, but from Nirvana itself. And which is quite, and I find this quite funny in that the opening track, Serve the Servants, I listened to it, and like within the first like 15 seconds, it sounded like another band. And funny enough, it's a band that I probably know a lot less about than I do Nirvana, because immediately I was expecting the Manic Street Preachers, because it's and I was expecting like Kelly Johnson to start singing with his Welsh accents, and I'm assuming this was like slightly just before they kind of broke out. And you just feel, and you can kind of hear, like Wolf Alice are a band I absolutely love, and you can kind of hear the genealogy of that from here as well. A lot of bands I listen to were influenced by Riot Girl, but then there's kind of like, it's kind of like if Riot Girl was the mummy, like Nirvana was the daddy, and they kind of had offspring. You see the paternal side of stuff as well, and it's...
Yeah.
I just found it kind of like a fascinating kind of like history lesson for me in terms of it, and I just click with it, and it's kind of the music I quite like. The sound of it just ticks a lot of my boxes.
Yeah, definitely. I think the way I'm delighted to hear that. And the view I've always had on this album is that Nevermind, a lot of people consider Nevermind to be, you know, both the commercial and critical zenith of Nirvana. I think the commercial side is undeniable, but I would argue that this album is Nirvana's creative peak, in my opinion. And I know you touched on Serve the Servants there, which is the first track on the album, and I just think it's such a good opening track for this album, because it immediately sets the scene of, you know, this is different. This is not Nevermind. You know, we are reacting to our own success, in a sense, in a still incredibly catchy, you know, there are still pop elements within that song and lots of songs on the album. But it's got a slightly fuzzier edge to it.
So the Servants works quite well, particularly I found it for me as well, because I'm coming into more or less Nirvana cold, with the exception of Smells Like Teen Spirit, and the fact the drummer went on to do a band or something like that. named after a plane, I think.
I've heard of them. I think I know who you mean.
And So the Servants works really well, I think, as an entry point, I think, for the band as well, because it's like coming to you load up Netflix and you turn on to a scene and you can't be bothered watching the first two seasons, so you've got like the script, so you have the recap and you've got the skip recap button, and if you click skip recap, you'll skip this song. It's the only thing that's missing is like a really deep voice going, "Previously on Nirvana." You've got like example, and the opening line's brilliant. Teenage angst has paid off well. Has paid off well. No one bored and old. It's kind of line I love, and it tells you the mission statement for the band and the album. And then the second verse kind of goes back and retreats a bit to Kurt's own kind of past or his own kind of mindset, and it gives you like a very good overview of what to expect from the band and the album, and it works really well.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. And there's a line later on in the song as well where, I mean, obviously the opening there addresses their success directly. And there's a line later on in the song, "As my bones grew, they did hurt. They hurt really bad. I tried hard to have a father, but instead I had a dad," which is very personal as well to Kurt Cobain and his background, where he didn't really have a relationship with his father and all that sort of stuff. So it's very, very personal album from the outset.
Yeah. And I know pretty much jumped into the first track, I think, like, naturally from the conversation, but as the album as a whole, if I was to ask you about some of the highlights that jump out for you, which songs could you name off the top of your head?
Well, I listened to your episode with Tim fairly recently. When I knew I was going to be coming on and joining you, I'd listened to a couple of your episodes before, and I thought I'd catch up with the rest. And Tim said something about the album that he did with you, and about how it all kind of blends, and it's difficult to pick an individual song. This one's similar, but not the same, in the sense that I don't think it's a piece like that album that you have to listen to, you know, completely in context. You can pick out individual tracks and listen to them. But it's one of those albums, especially for me, where I chop and change my favourite songs on the album quite a lot, which is probably you know, a statement to the overall quality of the album. In terms of tracks that stand out, Serve the Servants is one, just because I think it's such a great opener. Heart-Shaped Box obviously is one of the, has become one of their sort of iconic singles behind things like Lithium and Smells Like Teen Spirit. But I really like the snappiness of Very Ape. I think that's a good song. Radio Friendly Unit Shifter is one that I always get drawn to when I'm listening to the album. And Penroyal Tea as well is a really different kind of track, but it's a lovely listen.
Particularly, I think Penny Royalty, I think, was like the ones I quite liked as well. And I mean, if you look into the history of that, apparently you wrote it in like about 30 seconds, apparently. And
I think another track that's quite an interesting one is Frances Farmer Will Have Her Revenge on Seattle, which is a bit of a mouthful. But that's obviously Kurt Cobain's from Seattle, and Frances Farmer was an actress in the sort of early golden age of Hollywood, and she was involved in a scandal. And I think she may have, I'm not a massive knowledge on Frances Farmer, but I think she may have took her own life in the end as a result. And him, Kurt Cobain and Courtney Love, especially around this time, we're a little sort of fascinated by the Frances Farmer story, because it has had parallels at the time with Kurt Cobain's own story, because she was hounded by the press at the time in a similar way to him and Courtney Love at this point. And there's a lovely line in that track. She'll come back as fire to burn all the liars and leave a blanket of ash on the ground, which I thought was very visual.
Like, a common theme is kind of the, like, attacking the attention that he got from everyone. And I mean, I've not delved too much into Frances Farmer, but I don't think she died of cancer, I think, rather than taking her own life. But apparently she was, again, I'm only basing from what I read off Genius and a very quick scan of Wikipedia, but I think she was like institutionalized because of schizophrenia.
That's right, and I
think she was, and I believe some of the argument was there that it was, if not caused by media attention, it was kind of spurred on by it. And again, that's, I think that's kind of like the argument that Kurt makes throughout not just this song but quite a few of the other ones as well. But he uses a Seattle actress, and I think the band are from Seattle.
Yeah.
Is there a lot of, if not in this album, but is there a lot of kind of like hometown or home city pride that comes from Kurt and the band throughout the albums?
I think Kurt always had a bit of a weird relationship with his background. He was from a little town called Aberdeen, which in Washington State is about an hour away from Seattle. He hated his upbringing in this town. I think Chris Novoselic was from the same town as well. And it was kind of like this sort of backwater where there was absolutely nothing to do. And it was like a logging town, I think. And Seattle was their sort of their big escape from the town that they lived in that they hated. So I think pride, I don't know if that's necessarily the word, but there's certainly, I think, quite a strong emotional attachment to Seattle, because it was an escape route from the town that he grew up in.
With some of the other songs on the album, I think there's a lot, I think there's quite a lot of duality meaning in, and by that I mean there's like a lot of like kind of literal takes you can take on an album on some of the songs, but then there's perhaps another take you can take if you kind of sit back and think about it. I wasn't gonna mention it this early, but I think it probably should do, is that the song Rape Me,
yes,
is listening to it, it was probably, I kind of almost recognised it, or at least recognised the name. Reading into like the history of the song and like and like on a down the rabbit hole of like people debating it online, it's a very simple song in terms of lyrics, but
yeah,
there's a lot going on and a lot of discussion about it.
Oh goodness me, yes, absolutely, and not just lyrically as well. In that, I think there's the intro to it specifically, and the way it's structured is almost like a little bit of an inversion of, or it reminds me certainly of the intro to "Smells Like Teen Spirit" in a sense. It has a sort of similar chord pattern to it, and I think that was a kind of deliberate sort of tying together of what Kurt Cobain felt that he was. Well, he felt he was being abused and raped, essentially, by the media and by celebrity culture at the time. And I think he sort of blamed Smells Like Teen Spirit as a song for partly for putting him in that situation. And I've always found that sort of similarity between the opening sort of few chords for those two songs quite interesting, and I think probably quite deliberate.
I think on Wikipedia there's like a brief story about that they wanted to play the song at the MTV Music Awards in 1992, but apparently yes, there was kind of like strong-armed into playing Smells Like Teen Spirit instead. Yeah. But then I think they kind of, and apparently they started playing the intro to this song just to wind people up. Apparently,
that's right. Yeah, I've seen that performance online. It's worth a watch. He does play that intro. Yeah, you're quite right.
Quick mention about Heart Shaped Box.
Yes.
Yes. Which I mean, on the first listen, is pretty much like a kind of twisted love story, and you can kind of see why Lana Del Rey would cover it. And then in 2012. Courtney Love responded on Twitter saying, "You know it's about my vagina, don't you?"
Yeah, I think you know it probably is similarly to Rate Me. There's a more literal translation of that song and a more artistic one, shall we say?
Yeah, I mean, is that similar to what happens in earlier albums as well?
Yes, that is a theme that. That is sort of spread throughout Nirvana's work, slightly less on Bleach, but as I say, that was much more of a sort of very much them still searching for their voice and their sound. But yeah, I think there's certainly elements of that in play in some tracks in on Nevermind in particular, tracks like In Bloom. I would say that's something that is kind of smattered throughout their discography.
Okay, and that's one I want to quickly mention. I think I might have heard of this one as well. Thinking about it, All Apologies, the closer. Because that serves as a nice epilogue and a bookend to, in comparison to the intro of Serve the Servants. All Apologies is kind of like. It's not exactly upbeat, but it's kind of like an upbeat sounding song. Which fun fact that apparently the first time it ever played live was basically down the road from me, in the Wolverhampton Civic Hall in 1991.
Wow, Wolverhampton. That is a good fact, isn't it?
Yeah.
All Apologies is an interesting one because I've kind of read in various bits and bobs and places in the past that. There were some tracks that Kurt Cobain was quite unhappy with the mix on this album. And this was one of them, apparently, and that's why he was so keen to have that as part of the unplugged set, because he wanted to arrange it in a slightly different way, which it is. If you listen to the unplugged album, the arrangement is quite different, and it's quite interesting to listen to the two, actually, and stand them next to each other. But the production of this album, which I'll come on to because it's sort of related to the sort of general feel of the album, is it was quite a heavily delayed album. So the record label wanted to capitalize on Nevermind as soon as possible. And obviously Kurt Cobain was going through quite a lot of personal problems post Nevermind. And it was originally supposed to come out about a year before it did. In its place, they released Incesticide, which is a collection of B-sides, which is quite an interesting, if obviously incoherent, listen, because it's not an album by design. the problems that they developed during the course of the production of In Utero was, as I sort of touched on earlier, Kurt Cobain was quite, one of the things he was unhappy with Nevermind about was the, it was very slickly, quite slickly produced by Butch Vig. And so he wanted still Steve Albini to produce this album, because Albini had a reputation for being much more sort of rough and ready in his production approach. And the reason why there is a second producer credited is because there was a bit of a standoff between the band and the label over Albini's first cut, if you like, of the album, because the record label felt they couldn't market it. It was too inaccessible, deliberately so, I think. So the second producer was brought in kind of at the behest of the label to try and smooth things out and make it a little bit more radio friendly. So that's why there are two producers credited on the album, I believe.
Okay. The production of it is kind of interesting. I mean, apparently, I can't find the quotes, but I do know that somewhere Cobain said he initially expected not to warm to Albini, but then eventually would then say that it was probably the easiest record to record at the time. And there's an interesting mindset, I think, that's that was like developed as well, where Albini pretty much banned everyone, including label and A&R personnel. It was pretty much just him and the band, apparently.
Yes,
there was a lead in there, yeah. and that kind of stopped him from, basically stopped external people going, like kind of producers just going and going, don't you think we should do this? And I quite like that idea, that they're pretty much like going, no, you can bog off, we're doing it our way.
Exactly, yeah, exactly. And obviously, conversely, I think that's what caused the record label to panic slightly when they were eventually allowed to hear it. And hence I think the second producer was involved at that point. But yeah, absolutely. So it's a really interesting way to make an album. I think it really does show if you listen to it in relation to Nevermind, you can definitely tell.
Do you know what much difference Steve Litt did? Not so. Do you know how much difference Scott Litt did?
I don't specifically know. I think it was just general polishing. They tried to do some doubling on quite a few tracks, which Kurt Cobain refused to do, because that was his main issue with Nevermind, was that a lot of the tracks he was doubled on and sometimes trebled on, and he hated that, and he hated it at the time. But he was only talked into it by the producer of the first album, who basically turned around to him and said, you know, the Beatles did it. And Kurt Cobain was a huge Beatles fan, so that kind of satisfied him at the time. But I think when he came to making Utero, he was quite resistant to that. But yeah, in terms of Scott Litt's contribution, I think it was more general sort of polishing and trying to take off some of the harder edge. I think that's what I read about his contribution.
Okay, and I think the doubling of the vocals, that's, if I understand it correctly, because my technical side of music is quite limited, I think that's when you just basically record over the same vocals again, and you have that kind of like, you can tell there's like two, it seems like there's two people singing, but it's the same person.
Exactly.
I know rap uses it a lot, and I know quite a lot of bands particularly start using it a lot as well. I don't think I actually deliberately noticed it, but I'm assuming there's a lot less of it, if hardly any, in this album.
Yeah, definitely. Noticeably less in this album than Nevermind. You can definitely hear that in the album.
There's some interesting things that have been written about it. I mean, there's in 2003, I think, a Guitar World article written by Charles R. Cross argued In Utero was a far better record than Nevermind, and one that only 10 years later seemed to be an influential seed spreader, judging by current bands. It is possible for an album that sold 4 million copies to be overlooked or underappreciated, then In Utero is that lost pearl. I think Christopher John Farley kind of summed up the best one that I've read about the album. Despite the fears of some alternative music fans, Nirvana hasn't gone mainstream, though this potent new album may once again force the mainstream to go Nirvana.
Yeah, that's a great quote. That's quite a famous quote with regard to album, and I think that's absolutely nail on head.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the the kind of influence Nirvana kind of, like, he's felt throughout pretty much music to this day, like, what, 20, nearly 30 years.
Yeah,
27 years from Nevermind or something? Give or take, my crap maths.
Yeah.
I mean, like, I'm assuming that your kind of music, your music taste today, is it very similar? Is it influenced by Nirvana?
Yeah, I think it is. I think it is. A lot of the sort of music that I listen to definitely has its roots and its influences in grunge and the sort of grunge culture that Nirvana really produced in that time period. To this day, I always have a preference for albums that are that are not overproduced and that are quite rough and ready sounding than the sort of, you know, you listen to a great number of albums doing your podcast, and you can sometimes hear the production, if that makes sense, on an album sometimes more than the music itself. I find that quite off-putting. So yeah, definitely from a production perspective and all that side of it, yeah, Nirvana certainly influenced my music choices.
So if you don't mind me asking, what kind of like bands are you into now that you could arguably wouldn't have gotten into if you hadn't listened to Nirvana?
That's a great question.
Sorry to put you on the spot.
No, that's okay. I mean, not necessarily modern music, but music I like, bands such as the Pixies, who I adore, I would never have got into if it wasn't for Nirvana and for the fact that Kurt Cobain cited them as an influence. And in terms of modern music, I'm quite into bands like Royal Blood, who there's very much a sort of harder edge to the sort of recording of their albums, and a lot of their sort of rhythms are quite sort of Nirvana-esque. The drumming's very similar as well, and you can kind of hear those influences in there. And bands such as, you know, Queens of the Stone Age, that I've been a big fan of for a lot of years, you can kind of hear that sort of sleazier edge to their work as well.
Mm-hmm. Queens of the Stone Age, interesting one. Is that the supergroup that Dave Grohl's part of? Or am I confused?
He drummed on their album Songs for the Deaf in 2003. He's not a part of, I know the group you mean, but the name's completely slipped my mind.
Oh, yeah, it's Josh...
Josh Homme.
But then he has a super group with Dave Grohl called Those Crooked Vultures.
That's it. Yes. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, yeah, that's correct. That's the one. Mm-hmm. I actually very, very nearly picked Queens of Stone Age's first album as my choice. But I'm sticking by In Utero for sure.
Yeah. Actually, speaking of Dave Grohl, Dave Grohl, famously the drummer for Nirvana. The other guy whose name escapes me, Chris something, wasn't it?
Chris Novoselic.
Yeah. We've spoken a lot about Cobain because it is pretty much very difficult to separate the two. And to this day, you probably find people that listen to Foo Fighters who are probably surprised that Dave Grohl was part of Nirvana. The influence of those two on Nirvana, did they have much of an influence?
Yes, they did. I mean, not so much. Dave Grohl wasn't the drummer on the first album. He came after. Not so much on Nevermind, but certainly In Utero, sort of a little bit In Utero, and the sort of tracks that they were putting together for a proposed fourth album. I think Dave Grohl started writing some of the songs. I think he may have even sang on one of the songs that was that they were preparing for the album that never followed In Utero. So I think their influence, certainly Dave Grohl's influence, was growing within the band.
And I'm wondering whether that led to the formation of Foo Fighters in the end. Well, I think Kurt Cobain's death, I think, had an impact, sadly. But,
yeah.
I mean, are you much a fan of Foo Fighters? Or?
I am, yes, I am. I kind of have albums of theirs which I like and albums of theirs which I don't. But yeah, by and large, I've seen them live a couple of times, and they're one of those bands that sort of takes me back to my teenage years as well. So I have a sort of bit of emotional attachment to them for that reason. But yeah, I would consider myself to be a fan of Foo Fighters. Yeah,
see, Foo Fighters for me, and this might offend some people. I'm not a massive fan of Foo Fighters in general. I find them to be very much a singles band. I mean, they've got some really great songs, but I just can't listen to an album from them.
I mean, yeah, I can see that completely. Yeah. The only one of their albums that I consider to be a sort of complete album, I mean, maybe the first one a little bit, but they made an album probably about 3 or 4 years now ago called Wasting Light. Might have been longer ago. And that as an album is much more complete than a lot of their albums. I can see completely where you're coming from.
Yeah.
There.
I mean, like, I think a Greatest Hits album would be great by them, actually. I mean, they've got great songs. Learn to Fly, I love. Breakout is great. Best of You is amazing. But then I've tried to get into albums, and they just kind of just get lost in them, and it's a shame as well, because I've said this on, if not on the podcast, to people, and that is that Dave Grohl annoys me because I really like him. I just don't like his band that much.
Yeah.
He's got a very good mindset in terms of music, in terms of, he always seems to like to support like bands with a lower profile. And there's famously, I can't remember where exactly it was, it's somewhere in Italy where the a community wanted the band to play. So this guy kind of organised 1,000.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, I saw that online. Yeah.
Yeah, there's like 250 singers, 250 guitarists, 250 bassists, and 250 drummers doing a cover of Learn to Fly in an appeal to get the Foo Fighters to play there, and it worked, actually. I think the Foo Fighters kind of like replied on Twitter saying, well, we're amazed, we'll be in touch, and they eventually played there and stuff. And
yeah, it's a great story. Yeah,
like the impact of Foo Fighters on more clean modern rock isn't to be underestimated, particularly like pop rock. But and you can trace that back to Nirvana, and again back to perhaps more Nevermind than this one. But the impact that they have and the legacy they have, I mean, it's undeniably there. Yes. And like a lot of modern guitar music. And as I mentioned before, the distortion pedal, not just on the guitar, but perhaps on the mic of the vocalist as well. And like just laying off on the cough sweets to have that more gruff like sound. It's there in the album. And I found it really enjoyable to listen to. And it was just like, and I can pretty much see myself listening to this post recording this, actually.
Yeah. Absolutely. I mean, I've been working away a little bit recently, so I've been driving quite a bit. And I, on my way home on Friday night, I stuck the album on and listened to it through on my journey. And the things that always strike me about it, and I've carried this forward with a lot of other albums I like, I've found this is kind of a thread, is that its runtime is quite punchy. I think I've got it written down here, 41 minutes 23. And the songs individually are punchy, and it's an album that from that opening track, Serve the Servants, it kind of grabs you by the scruff of the neck and doesn't let go. And it flies by, it literally flies by as I listen through.
Yeah. Again, that's probably one of the reasons that I quite like it. And it's something that's come up in the past as well, in that it's in the sweet spot of how long an album should be. Yeah. And I think that's great. I think as we're moving on, I was going to quickly ask a couple of the, as we come to a close, it's a strange question to ask, and I think I'm going to guess the answer to it, but have you ever seen Nirvana live?
Sadly not, no. I was a little bit too young when Nirvana were around. I have some half-brothers who are all quite a bit older than me, and one of them was present for their famous concert at the Reading Festival, which he reminds me of on an almost weekly basis to this day, and I am more jealous of him for that than I could be of anybody for anything.
So which performance was that? Which Reading Festival?
I believe it was Reading 92. It was the famous festival where there's a lot of concerns around Cobain's health in the lead up, and there was a lot of rumour that they might not make the festival. And Kurt famously came out in a wheelchair with a wig and a hospital gown on, and he stood up from the wheelchair and tried to sing a line, and then collapsed to the floor and laid there for about a minute. While the crowd are all sort of in hushed silence, and then eventually jumps up and basically gives one of their greatest live performances.
Okay, yeah, actually, I knew he came on in a wheelchair once. I didn't realise it was that one. And you know, if I was your older brother, I understand why he keeps mentioning it. That is probably one of the better gigs to remember.
Yes, but, exactly.
So, if like me, people who listen to the album because of this episode and have not listened to any other stuff from Nirvana, where would you suggest myself and the other listeners to listen to? What else to listen to?
Well, of course, Nevermind goes without saying. That would absolutely be the next part of Call Nirvana wise. I think there's a really nice MTV Unplugged album that they did. So, well, it was released posthumously in the end. I think it was a couple of months before Kurt died that it was recorded. That's a lovely listen from a completely sort of different perspective. If we're talking about sort of bands outside of Nirvana for further listening, I would heartily recommend the Pixies sort of back catalogue from the mid to late 80s / early 90s. There's some really good listening in there. If you enjoyed In Utero, I would urge you to seek out their back catalogue as well.
Oh, okay. I should then. Cause like going further back into the history of a genre I quite like.
Yes.
So, and the most important question is the playlist. We can get into the playlist.
Oh, yes. This has been giving me sleepless nights, the playlist.
You only got one job, and that's to...
I know, yes.
You got one job, and that's to add to the legacy.
Exactly, of the playlist. Exactly.
Yeah, so you've got... So for those who perhaps this is their first out... First listen, I asked the guests to choose one song to go into the legacy that is the Spotify playlist. I cannot veto it. What Rob says goes. So, Rob, which song have you picked to be immortalised forever?
I've been struggling with this. Several contenders. I mean, Heart-Shaped Box is the obvious one, but I think I'm going to pick a track from the album that very few people will know unless they have an intimate knowledge of the album. I was going to say Serve the Servants as well, but I'm going to go with Radio Friendly Unit Shifter, which is my current favourite song on the album, and something that will get overlooked unless you have a fairly intimate knowledge of the album. So I'll go with Radio Friendly Unit Shifter.
Okay, good choice.
Thank you very much.
He says facing the microphone rather than his notepad. So, and with that, I think it's time to bring the conversation to a close. Thank you ever so much for talking Nirvana, Rob, and introducing me or getting me to sit down and listen to this. I mentioned in the past was one of the reasons I did this was eventually some people were going to choose more classic albums that I've not listened to or not had the drive to. And yeah, this is perhaps the top one that I've listened to so far in terms of like legacy albums. And I really enjoyed it. I've enjoyed reading into the lyrics, just listening to it in the background whilst doing housework. Thank you ever so much for introducing that to me. And before we say goodbye properly, if people want to find you and your work and your podcast, where can they find you?
Sure. So I am, my personal Twitter is @DancingHenry. And I have a podcast with Chris Wilson, who you've had on in the past, where we cover the sublime and the ridiculous of horror remakes and sequels. And that is the Cinemortuary podcast. And you can find us @Cinemortuary on Twitter. And we are a fellow member of the We Made This family.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So thank you, Tony.
Yeah. Thank you, our Lord Tony. Lord and
indeed,
Saviour.
Our Lord and Saviour, yes.
if you bear with us a moment, we'll pray to him.
Yes, indeed, indeed. We are speaking on the Sabbath, so we should should both go and praise him now.
Yes, I'll turn to my shrine.
Likewise.
Yeah, it's pinned upon a dartboard. I'll remove the darts from the move the darts from his poster. No, he's again graciously hosting us for us. And with that, Rob, all I want to say is thank you ever so much for speaking about In Utero by Nirvana.
Thank you very much for having me, and I'm thrilled that you enjoyed the album.
No problem, and I must apologise to Helena and Phoebe Bridges for having their top spot knocked off finally.
Yes, but, there we go. I'm honoured. I can't contain my excitement.
You've been listening to Pick a Disc, and I've been your host, Matthew Layla. Our theme music is Pump by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com. Pick a Disc is hosted by the We Made This podcast network, and you can find them on www.spreaker.com/user/WeMadeThis. You can find the Pick a Disc show site on www.spreaker.com/show/pickadisc. You can find us on all the usual social media type places like Facebook, Instagram, Twitter under Pick a Disc. You can also email us on pickadisc@gmail.com. Until next time, happy listening to all those discs that you are picking. Goodbye.